Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development Finance and Policy Committee. I see that we do have a quorum in the room. I know we've got a member or two that might be excused today. Vice Chair Mecklen, would you look over the minutes from yesterday and make sure we're ready to go? I think there's a small typo, but Rep. Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, if we can just simply change order at 8:36 on Wednesday, not Tuesday. That's the error. March 5th, 2025.
Thank you.
I move those minutes.
Thank you very much. Any further comments? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Any opposed? Minutes are carried from yesterday, Wednesday, March 4th. Again, today, members and audience here, we do have a very full agenda, like most days we do. Anybody that's testifying today, I'm asking that they keep their comments in around that three-minute range. We'll give you kind of a yellow card up if it's getting way off the rails, and we ask it, when you see the card, we're just to wrap it up, if you wouldn't mind doing that. We don't have a buzz or anything or a hook, so we appreciate you doing that. If we do go into the evening tonight, we do have this room also reserved for this evening as well. So we're hoping to get everything wrapped up today, but I want to make sure that the public knows that we are having this reserved for then as well. With that, I think I'm going to ask Representative Zeleznikar to go to the testifying table. We are going to start with House File 500. Good morning, Representative Zeleznikar. If you want to briefly go over the bill but as it is, but we want to focus probably on the amendment today, too. So you are welcome to go anytime. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and members. The AIM-1 amendment is just changing to have a three-pronged balanced approach to the voting members. It also has language about eliminating expedited rules, so that we make sure that we are in compliance federally and follow the same standards that we have in the past. And it also has...
Sorry, Representatives, I forgot to mention, too, the Chair also moves that House File 500 will be passed today and referred to the General Register. I forgot to mention that, so thank you. As amended at some point, yeah. Thank you. Continue.
Thank you, Chair, members. And the third component of the amendment just has wording in there for training to include industry leaders in the nursing home realm that historically have done training opportunities for nursing homes across the state. This is not a repeal. This is this is going to make this bill better and make this move forward in the sense of having some parameters around it that are reasonable for the nursing home industry.
All right. Thank you, Representative Zeleznikar. Member comments on the amendment as presented? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The amendment A1 has been amended to the bill. Thank you. Are there further amendments to the bill today? Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I thought we might discuss the bill ahead of time, but I have the what I believe is the A3. Is that right?
The DE3, I believe.
It's the DE, yeah, the DE3. And what this bill is, or what this amendment does, is, and as we heard yesterday from the board and board chair, the work is starting and proceeding, and we are actually quite hopeful and grateful about what the work is happening. What this amendment does is replace what I think is a bill that guts and sort of distorts the actual work of the bill with some of the technical amendments and the implementing amendments that we need. There are actually two other bills that we may hear in this committee, or we may, if we just accept this amendment, be able to do that and not spend further time on it. Let me just explain the two pieces of this bill. So the first, the Section 1 and Section 2 are relatively technical, and what they do is bring in line the definition of nursing home and nursing home employers, which are slightly different, but the intent is to make is to go with the narrower definition, and specifically, and I believe that we could ask the board, but that this is the definition that they are currently working with, but that excludes the veterans home, private pay only facilities, facilities on tribal lands, and Medicare only rehabilitation nursing homes that are not in the board's purview, and I believe always were intended not to be in the board's purview. So because the term definitions nursing home and nursing home employers are slightly different, the first bill, the first amendment, two sections do that. Their language that the DLI presented at the board early in January, and my understanding is they're relatively non-controversial, so they're technical fix. The second piece of the amendment is a $1 million appropriation that is an implementing appropriation dealing with the bill requires that workers every 2 years get an hour of training on their rights and the board and how they can engage that way. And my understanding is that this is an amendment that Representative Egbaje has the bill, the full bill, but it is also relatively small, to allow funding for the trainers who are doing this. Now, for the third in nursing homes that are union, their union is probably already providing that. What this amendment would do would be to allow those other folks, the trainers, to fund that work. The curriculum is already ready to go. I think we could ask the board if we wanted to. It's really to fund the trainers and ensure that the nursing homes themselves don't have to pick up that extra hour that is required by law. So that is the purpose and the totality of this amendment. I'd offer it as a DE. I think this is actually the work that we need to do to strengthen and to implement the board that's already working. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'd ask for I believe we are going to withdraw it. I say this because I think the goal would be we may hear this bill or talk about it in negotiations, but I wanted to make sure we had the conversation because I think these are the pieces that we actually need to do to make this bill and this work stronger.
Very good. So Representative Greenman withdraws the DE3 amendment. Thank you. So Representative Zalesnikar, House File 500 as amended to your bill. Do you have some testifiers today?
Thank you, Chair Baker and members. I do.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kyle Berndt. I'm here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative to express support and walk through some of what's happening in House File 500 as amended. As the author already articulated on the amendment, it provides the standard which is applied to the state agency for appointees, providing all three groups, agencies, the agency staff, worker, and employer appointees, to have two affirmative votes to move rules forward. It removes expedited rulemaking from Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. I think members might have already seen the minority report. That was a contentious issue for those members from the employer side who were concerned that there wasn't much collaboration, and this would add to the process and provide an opportunity for additional hearings and have a full, thorough look at what the statement of need and reasonableness would be under that requirement. It would allow employer organizations, such as those that make up the Long-Term Care Imperative, to provide required training according to the statute. Our organizations already provide regular training to the industry and are a resource to our members on employment regulation, state and federal Medicaid requirements, and best practices in operating long-term care facilities, among many other numerous trainings. The proposal, as it has arrived to this committee, has changed from when it was introduced. House File 500 changes in the current cost estimation and statute to accurately reflect the cost of nursing homes. This change would require individual facility rate impact analysis, consider the increase in the cost to wages and other employment costs, such as taxes and unemployment. The proposal would make rules adopted by the board, which have not met these requirements, ineffective. The deleted statute considered the forecast as an indication for funding of these mandates. However, the system is not designed with this concept in mind. The forecast and modeling is based on actual costs to the VBR system. As a reminder, since this is Labor Committee and not Human Services, where we have these discussions regularly, there's a 15 to 27 month delay in reimbursements, which means those rates for next year are based on wages, activities, and food that have already been paid for in a previous year. In short, the model used in the statute does not align with the reality of the value-based reimbursement model. These requirements should be individually provided by the board for each facility, and the forecasted numbers are not inclusive of these rules, but rather an add-on to the forecast. This proposal is critical as we assess the state of Minnesota's nursing facilities coming out of a pandemic that placed unprecedented strain on the industry. We agree that caregivers deserve an increase in their wages. However, these unfunded mandates would hurt access to nursing homes in rural communities. We ask legislators to pay for the board's actions or render them ineffective and provide meaningful process that would ensure a collaborative board. We ask you support House File 500 as amended, and I'll turn it over to the other testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Burt. Good morning. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the president and CEO of Leading Age Minnesota, and I'm here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. You'll see I'm subbing in for Erin Hubert, who had a slight mishap this morning. She's all right, though, I promise. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this proposal is fairly straightforward. Either the legislature fully funds the mandates that have been promulgated by the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board, or those requirements should not take effect. That's simply what we are talking about today. We've collected examples of how these ill-conceived unfunded standards would impact Minnesota. So the first example is there's only one care center nursing home in Cook County. They estimate that the cost of the minimum wage mandate that has been promulgated will be $1.4 million between 2026 and 2027. This is a community-owned nursing home, which means that the community may need to double its local tax levy to maintain operations. And by the way, the closest non-veterans home to this particular nursing home is 80 miles away. So we are deeply concerned about both the financial viability of nursing homes without the funding, as well as access and service to those residents in that community. The nursing home shared these concerns and comments submitted to the board during the expedited rulemaking of the minimum wage rule. Another metro provider estimates nearly $500,000 in annual expense to comply with holiday pay. There is also written testimony in your packets from a care center in New Ulm that estimates it will either need to drain all of its reserves or take out a loan to cover the $723,000 in annual new costs for the mandates, because these are unfunded mandates. Concerns like these were raised by the three employer representatives of the board, who all represent nursing homes. Through also the Long-Term Care Imperative raised these concerns to no avail. In fact, the three employer members of the board had their motives impugned and their concerns entirely dismissed. You'll see those concerns also articulated in the minority report, which I believe you discussed yesterday. The last 18 months have made it very clear. Unless the legislature takes action this year to make the changes proposed in the bill before you, the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board will continue to ignore community providers, minimize the impact of the actions on the access to care, and weaponize its expedited rulemaking authority. We fully support wages for caregivers, and I want to make that very clear. We have consistently advocated for increasing wages for caregivers. And incidentally, we also oppose the Medicaid cuts, like those proposed in Governor Walz's proposed budget, that would affect the care that is delivered to residents, the activities they enjoy, and yes, the wages and the number of people that we can hire. We urge the legislature to either fund these mandates or to render them ineffective until they can be paid for. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much, members. Testifiers, for your testimony this morning. Thank you so much. Next up, if we could have Ms. Brees come to the table, as well as Mr. Elliott, if you'd come forward. You guys are on deck. And then we will have a Zoom call after that. And again, we always appreciate around that 3-minute mark, so thank you so much. Ms. Brees, you are welcome to proceed. Please introduce yourself and continue.
Thank you, Chair Baker and the committee. My name is Teresa Brees. I do laundry at a nursing home in Roseville. I'm a member of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota in Iowa. We oppose House File 500, which would cripple the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. I want to thank Representative Celeste Nacar for her amendment in the last committee. It moved away from a full repeal of the board. We appreciate a step in the right direction. Brian Elliott from SEIU State Council will talk about our remaining concerns. I want to talk about why the paid holiday rule and the minimum wage rule are so important. I have worked in long-term care for over 25 years. Because we were so short-staffed, I worked 23 straight days. Eventually, I tore my bicep tendon and was barely able to lift my arm. I've struggled with this injury ever since. Low pay and lack of benefits caused so many of my coworkers to leave. We just aren't treated with the respect we deserve. I was part of the largest nursing home strike in Minnesota history last March because so many of us were fed up. I was excited the board spent so much time listening to people across the state and decided as first steps to create minimum wages and offer time and a half holiday pay. It's amazing how many people have already gotten paid holidays on Martin Luther King and President's Day who previously didn't get anything extra. And the wage increases are going to be incredibly helpful. In my eyes, as a nursing home worker, the board is doing amazing to address the staffing crisis and all known crisis we all know is a problem for Minnesotans. I think more jobs should have a board like this. I'm sure employers don't like having total power anymore, but their way wasn't working. I ask you to vote no on this bill and hope you can find better ways to address any fiscal concerns. Thank you.
Ms. Brees, thank you, and thank you for your hard work in this industry that is already such a challenging thing to do. And 23 days in a row, I'm sorry about that, but thank you for doing it and stepping up. So thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Elliott, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Brian Elliott. I am the Executive Director for the Service Employees International Union, Minnesota State Council. SEIU represents over 60,000 workers across the state who provide care and support for families in a variety of settings, from individual homes to schools to hospitals and the state's largest commercial buildings, and including thousands of dedicated workers in nursing homes. Thanks again for the opportunity to testify today on House File 500. Unfortunately, SEIU still cannot support the bill at this time. We appreciated the amendment in the Human Services Committee, but we have a number of concerns about the A1 amendment and are afraid that it moves the conversation backward. And quite frankly, this conversation is what the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board is all about. The question being, how can workers, employers, and government regulators come together to solve the biggest problems facing an industry, which in this case is the significant and growing nursing home workforce shortage? The key, as the industry representatives also mentioned, is collaboration. And what I heard attending board and work group meetings was the universal agreement that the industry representatives also mentioned in wanting to support our essential nursing home workers. In fact, that was the reason given by the industry representatives for abstaining on the rules. They wanted to support their workers and raise their wages, but they needed to focus on more funding for the industry. Unfortunately, often unrelated funding to the specific board standards. And this narrow focus seems to have unfortunately gotten in the way of industry representatives working collaboratively on the issues before the board. And we know this, we've experienced this. This is sadly unsurprising. Worker advocates have repeatedly offered to work with the industry to advocate together for a solution to the funding issues they've raised. But when we raise our need for accountability to ensure that those state dollars are actually addressing the workforce shortage, we're told thanks, but no thanks. They'll talk about the money, but nothing else. We know the reason this is important is we know that wages and benefits haven't kept pace with nursing home rate increases over the last decade. We know that this bill will reward operators who have been chronically underinvesting in their workforce. We know that what this bill is trying to address is exactly why there is a waiver process. Facility-specific concerns are meant to be addressed by the waiver process. And we know that the way that funding is to be computed in this bill fails to account for natural wage growth. It demands upfront funding of wage increases that would have happened anyway, rather than just the additional wage growth from the rule. And while we would agree, I think everyone would agree, that the current funding system is imperfect, we know that the board standards are not unfunded. I want to be real clear about this. The board standards are not unfunded. The values-based reimbursement system reimburses the cost, all of the costs that are spent on these wages. They are fully funded, just not on a timeline that the industry prefers. And I understand that that is a problem. And so with that, I want to thank the author. I want to thank you as a committee. And I will be around for the rest of the discussion today and will entertain any questions. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott. Appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you so much.
Next up, we have on Zoom Vicki and Samantha Nagy, if I have that correct. And if you can hear us okay, you can unmute yourself and please proceed.
Okay. Yeah. Hi. Yes, I'm, Yes, I'm Vicki Kanagi. It's Kanagi. I'm from Southwest Minnesota, Worthington. I am a practical, I'm a licensed practical nurse at South Shore Care Center in Worthington. I am also a member of AFSCME Local 105. I've been working at South Shore for 12 years now. And for that entire time, staffing has been an issue. Because of the short staffing, it is hard to stay safe on our jobs. Since the legislation enacted the Nursing Home Standards Board, we have seen improvements in conditions, and that is why I'm here to voice my opinion for in opposition of House File 500. I believe this would put these gains at risk. As an LPN, I provide vital care to our nursing home residents. However, I do love my job, and that is why I've been in this role for over a decade. The nurses I do work with also love their jobs, but we find it extremely challenging. We are underpaid for the work we do, and because of the chronic staffing shortages, we are often asked to do more for less. Burnout among our nursing staff is a very serious issue, and it's hard to get people recruited and retained in these positions, especially here in rural Minnesota. The LPNs and other nursing home workers, that would be all nursing home workers, we do know how to fix some of these problems, and that's why the Nursing Home Board is very important to us. We're able to voice our opinions. We can we can be part of the solution, and that's I appreciate the author's amendment eliminating that language to repeal the board, but I am concerned about the new language that would make it difficult to implement the board's standards, and that's why I'm opposing House File 500, and I respectfully ask that you vote no to this file. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kanagi. Appreciate that. And sorry I got your name wrong at the end, but thank you so much. And Samantha?
Oh, that's okay.
Is that okay? Thank you.
Yep. Hi. Yeah,
hi.
I'm right here.
Hi, good morning.
Dear Chair Baker and the members of the committee, good morning. My name is Samantha Carnegie. I also work at South Shore Care Center in Worthington. I am a dietary aide and a member of Ask Me Local 105. I've been working as a dietary aide for about a year, meaning I have only been working in nursing homes since the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board was created. Based on what I've seen, the board is desperately needed as it currently functions with the nursing home staffing crisis. This is why I oppose of House File 500. I'm a dietary aide because I care about my community and I want to help people. I like the residents I serve and I work hard to make them feel at home. However, the job has really taken a toll on me mentally. We are always burning through staff. We are constantly having to train in new people, which is difficult for both nursing home staff and residents. We really don't get paid enough for the hard work we put in. I currently make $15.25 an hour, and I have sometimes wanted to quit because I know that I could easily make money elsewhere. Without benefits like time and a half on holidays and knowing that the industry-wide minimum wages are coming, I would have already left. I'm glad the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board exists and that workers like me can have a role in shaping the standards for our industry. We fought hard for the minimum wage, and I want to continue pushing for better working conditions. I don't want there to be new requirements that would change how effective the board can be. Please vote no on House File 500.
Thank you very much, Samantha. We really appreciate hearing from you this morning. That concludes our testimony that signed up ahead of time. Are there other members of the public that would like to speak for or against this bill? Seeing none, I'll close public comments. And to the members. Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lesnikar, for bringing this bill. I would say about 35 years ago now, my sister, in one of her first jobs in our small town, worked at the nursing home, and she worked in what I think we now call memory care. And she would be devastated when she lost someone under her care. And from what I know of you, I know that matters to you and the type of workers that we attract to work in our nursing home matter to you. And those are exactly the kind of people and the people that we heard from today are the kind of people that we want caring for our parents and our grandparents when they become probably the most vulnerable stages of their life. And I don't think that we can just thank them when they sit in front of us and tell their stories and have that be enough. We need to follow that up with how we treat them and the changes that we make. And so the purpose of the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board is to give workers a voice in helping employers and regulators in collaboration, like we heard from our testifier, to solve the serious and growing issue of the workforce shortage. The same workers, like my sister, like the people that testified today, who know best why they're working in that industry and what it takes to retain and attract quality workers. So the bill and the A1 amendment would do nothing to help solve the shortage of nursing home workers. In fact, I'm not sure why we're bothering to amend the bill as introduced. These changes are just a more circumspect way of achieving that same goal, stopping the changes in the industry that workers have said they need today and in all the discussions leading up to today to attract those quality workers to care for our loved ones. So I keep hearing that this is unfunded, and here's my question. But if that's the case, how do nursing homes ever increase wages to stay competitive, and aren't wages part of the current reimbursement system that the industry advocated for and passed with bipartisan support, I think, more than 10 years ago?
Representative Zolzankar.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and thank you, Representative Berg. The value-based reimbursement absolutely is there for the nursing home business, and like I've said before on the House floor, it is about an 18 to 24 month delay. And so that is a rate that you get that is going to not include inflation. So obviously in the airline industry, I'm sure you're not getting reimbursed for, you're not going to have your pay be based on cost 2 years ago.
and be stuck at that rate. That is the reality in the nursing home business. And so the comprehensive care standards that you speak about, absolutely. I've been championing that for 30 years here. The legislative body sets those rates. And unfortunately, the issues of the funding mechanism when we had $18.5 billion were not done. We did an emergency Hail Mary for $300 million at the end of session, and that passed. But this is another issue. So what this bill is doing is strengthening the comprehensive standards to allow to make sure there's collaboration, which is the goal always, to have collaboration on the whole comprehensive perspective on how funding works and how the care works, because the ability to pay staff comes from this body. And that is what has always been true. And so both things can be true at one time. We have always had a standard of wanting the highest wages for dietary. I've worked side by side by dietary, maintenance, housekeeping, CNAs for over 30 years. And that is not a goal that's changed today.
Representative Berg.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I do. Thank you for explaining that to me. It's not my industry. You're right, in the airline industry. Well, actually, they do not pay us commensurate to current rates. But so my concern in listening to that answer is that the changes that this makes the rulemaking harder, makes the collaboration harder to achieve what you're talking about, to get everybody's input and to agree upon a standard. And so I think if I could call up Mr. Elliott for a question.
Sure. Mr. Elliott. Representative Berg.
Thank you. So based on the explanation given by Representative Zalesnikar, can you kind of help us understand from the work that you do on this issue a little bit more about how that works?
Mr. Elliott.
Well, thank you, Representative Berg, Mr. Chair. So I think the concern that we have expressed is that the values-based reimbursement system does reimburse the costs. And so, but again, there is that 15 to 27 month lag that the testifiers have indicated. The challenge, though, is that what this bill does is account for all of the costs that may or may not be attributable to the rule in order and require all of those up front in order for the rule to go into effect. For example, nursing homes raise wages to stay competitive. That's been happening forever. That is not a function of the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board rule on the minimum wage. The cost to the state is what was determined in the fiscal note on the rule, because that accounts for that natural wage growth and doesn't double count it. The other thing that we have concerns about in this bill are the indirect costs, which are defined very broadly, and what we've heard from DHS is that they don't actually know how they would determine those indirect costs, which are particularly speculative. What is going to be the wage compression? What might be the effect on an assisted living, on the wages in a related assisted living facility from raising the wages in the nursing home facility? And then it actually puts all of those costs in the nursing home. So we could, for example, see assisted living costs borne in the nursing home rates. And so that is why we support the way that the board has is currently structured in statute to require the fiscal analysis that is done on all the bills before the legislature and quite frankly, in my 26 years of lobbying, I've actually never seen a fiscal note that I thought was too small. quite often I take issue with fiscal notes, and I think most of us here have seen that take issue with fiscal notes that might be too high. So that's the process, and that is the concern we have about the way that this bill front loads those costs.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that, Mr. Elliott. I was asking a very clumsy question. I have a better understanding now. So it seems to me that currently how the board works provides the oversight that we need to make sure that we're getting this right. And as we've had lots of discussions on waste, fraud, and abuse, I appreciate the fact that we have the Workforce Standards Board for oversight on how this all works. And I want to leave enough time for questions for my colleagues. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pete Johnson.
And in this committee, we've also heard a number of different workforce-related initiatives to grow workers in these fields. And my concern is that if we don't take actions on how we treat and support these critical care workers, making sure that we show them how valuable they are when they take care of some of the most vulnerable within our communities, my first question is, how do we expect to retain them after we invest in getting them trained up and getting them into these facilities to not have them just choose to pursue a job elsewhere where they can make better money, have less raise, less stress, and just quit relying on their passion for doing this type of work?
Representative Johnson, was that a question for the author?
I was, yes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and thank you, Representative Johnson. That has been a 30-year process that I've been here at the Capitol fighting for the highest wages for nursing home workers. I was a nursing assistant. I cared for seniors for 40 years of my career. And so I've worked side by side. So make no mistake that it's the legislative body in the House that has decided the funding and at the Senate historically. And that is the job of this committee and every committee as we move forward on what we're going to prioritize. It wasn't a top priority in the 23-24 budget when we had $18 billion. And so I pushed hard for the $300 million for 2 years. At the end of 24, we got that done. And I'm grateful for that, and we continue to do that through having funding conversations through the medical assistance process, which 60 to 80% of our residents in Minnesota nursing homes are on medical assistance. We have rate equalization, and so that means private pay and medical assistance pay the same. There is no way to change the gap for additional funding. So we continue to do that through the rules we make at the state statutes. Thank you.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. I do have one quick follow-up here.
And,
you know, looking at the amendment, I agree with some of the testifiers.
Thanks. I agree with some of the testifiers that this is better than a full repeal. But my concern is, like, we talk about this encouraging collaboration, but I tend to disagree that when you give a minority group in that body, in essence, veto power over anything that board does, to me that doesn't foster collaboration. It allows more people to retreat into their corners and hold things hostage and ultimately gum up the works so that things don't move forward. So if there are ways to make this board work better and deliver what we needed to deliver to improve the conditions for those workers on the front lines providing that care, I think that's something that we should be doing, and I would like to see us stop doing that on the backs of workers. So I'll just close with that comment and just leave as much time as I can. So thank you, Chair.
Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. I want to follow up on a comment made earlier by Representative Berg. Representative Lesnikar, this bill started off as a full repeal. What caused you to change it to the version that came to our committee and then adding the amendment? Why did you not just stick with the full repeal that was originally in your bill?
Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Lead Pinto. I think it's important that we have collaboration, and the amendment offers making sure that we have 2 out of 3 in each classification of the board members to be a part of that process. It allows, it talks about the training in the amendment. I think having the leaders in the industries for nursing homes being able to be trainers is efficient. It makes sense. And so I think the bill is better in the capacity we're at today.
Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, Representative Lesnikar, I think you were talking about the amendment added on today, but why did you make the change from the original bill to not just repeal altogether? Why did you keep the board in place and with the change that you made, like in Human Services?
Representative Lesnikar.
I think thank you, Chair Baker and Lee Pinto. I think making changes is part of the collaborative process. And that's what you do when you're working together to move a bill to a successful place where you can have collaboration on both sides.
Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering I wonder if DHS in the room and able to comment on the bill at all? I don't know if there's somebody here who can. I see Ms. Bailey, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
Yeah.
I just had a question. Maybe she's walking, or we're trying to keep things moving. So the question is going to be, if you just comment on the ability to implement the bill as written and kind of how that would work.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, Ms. Bailey.
Thank you, Chair Baker and representatives. Elise Bailey, Budget Director of the Department of Human Services. We don't believe this bill is implementable as written, simply because the bill requires us to include indirect or secondary impacts in a fiscal analysis. And that is not allowed according to the LBO standards and procedures and how we're required to fiscal note a bill. Furthermore, there's no scope or definition of what would be included in an indirect impact. Would it be the impact to other services? For example, in previous committee, the nursing home providers mentioned that there would be ripple effects in, for example, assisted livings. Would we be required to incorporate those wage increases into the rates of nursing homes, for example, with this bill? So there's not enough definition, and even if there were, we don't believe we could incorporate any indirect impacts and do a fiscal note.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, yeah, besides that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln? I mean, it sounds like you're saying that, I mean, it's not, there's all kinds of ways this would not be able to be implemented by the agency that would be required to implement it. Is that essentially what you're saying, Ms. Bailey?
Ms. Bailey?
Chair Baker, Representative Pinto, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Representative Lesnikar, so that's a concern. I guess connected also to implementation, I don't know if this would be, Ms. Bailey can comment on this, or Representative Lesnikar, but the way the bill is written, the standard the board would try to advance would not be able to take effect without information from every single nursing home that it would apply to. So they would have to provide information or have to be the standard couldn't go forward without that information. I don't see anything that would require nursing homes to provide that information. And so if they don't like the standard the board is advancing, what would stop them from just the same, we're not going to participate in the process at all? And then at that point, it's just a veto on the process. If you think I'm reading that wrong, please tell me. But that's how it looks to me, if you can comment on that.
Representative Zosikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Lee Pinto. I think the testimony in the past through this bill has showed that the scope of the workforce board has language in it in different capacities for bringing information, getting information to the legislators on their studies for the wage increases that they're proposing through that process, and also acknowledges the BBRO valuation-based reimbursement that we have all talked about with an 18-month delay. And so that is the formula that nursing homes work under is a audit of the financials and then a reimbursement, so it will continue as is.
Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so I guess I'll wrap up. So I don't know that was responsive to what I was saying, Representative Lesnikar. I guess the concern is that the way your bill is written is that if the board advances a standard, and it's a standard perhaps that that employers are not happy with, they could simply not provide information. This is how I read the bill anyway, that they could simply not provide the necessary information. And the standard only goes into effect once every single nursing home in the state provides certain information, and there's nothing that would require them to do so. So I guess maybe just my overall comment is I don't think the bill, in fact, fundamentally has changed from how it was introduced, that when you combine these different pieces, that it can't be implemented, that any standard advanced by the board couldn't take effect practically unless employers are happy with it. And then with your amendment you've put in saying that that there would essentially be a veto by employers, I think this is gets away from the collaboration that you say that you're interested in. And essentially what this is this is still a repeal of the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. That is essentially what it is, because it would cause the board not be able to take any action at all. Also note that it takes away expedited rulemaking, and I won't get into that in further detail now, but just to note that all sorts to ways where the board ends up being so hamstrung that, in fact, it's the same as a repeal. So whether or not you introduced a repeal, which you did, or you have a bill that looks like it, how it is now, but is practically a repeal, the effect is the same. I think this is a great example of collaboration and balance among a number of different groups. And so I do have great concerns with the bill. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate this conversation. Thank you, Representative Zalesnikar. I know this is an area you have a lot of background in, and I'm trying to think that the shared goal of this committee, and my guess is of the legislature, is ensuring that we are providing long-term care, we are providing for our seniors, we are ensuring that folks in every part of the state have access to care, and that the folks who are providing that care can take care of their families, have working conditions that allow them to come home safe at work at night, and also that we're ensuring that, as we have heard, and I think you have talked about it, I know that we have heard in this bill, making sure that we have the workforce that can continually provide. My sister, before she was a nurse practitioner, she works in geriatrics, she was a PCA in long-term care, she was a nurse in long-term care, and I know how hard that job is. One of the things you said is it's the legislative body in the House that determines and decides the funding. And my understanding as somebody who does not serve on DHS, but is that 50% of the funding is federal Medicaid dollars. And I'm wondering, you know, today is forecast day. Last week we heard the Senate, in Senate Finance, they did a presentation where the commissioner, MMB commissioner, said with the proposed Medicaid cuts of $880 billion at the federal level, that would be about $1.2 to $1.6 billion annually lost here in Minnesota. And I'm wondering how that work, if our goal is to ensure that we're providing stability in nursing homes, stability for the workforce, and for our seniors, how that funding cut will impact those goals, and also what you propose the House would do about it, given that you said that the legislative body in the House is the one who determines the funding.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Or in the legislature.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and thank you, Representative Greenman. I'm glad you mentioned this, because Governor Waltz's budget includes a 2% cap on the value-based reimbursement, which essentially states, to your point, the concerns that have been brought to this body, that the actual expenses the nursing homes face are going to be beyond 2%, which in the past, while you had to wait 18 months to get the money, you would get an 8% increase in your rates if your costs went up 8%. The governor's budget is proposing a 2% cap, which will definitely impact Minnesotans in nursing homes, period. And that is going to be at least a $600 million loss in revenue if the Minnesota model of the proposed governor budget goes through. And that is absolutely relevant in the conversation.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm asking is how the Minnesota model will survive $1.2 to $1.6 billion cuts from Medicaid.
Representative Zalesnikar, if you want to talk about federal stuff, this would be your chance, or not to. Representative.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and Representative Greenman. Absolutely. I mean, the governor's model, regardless of what the federal government is doing, our governor is proposing a cut of almost $600 million plus to the nursing homes directly, which directly goes against the nursing home standard boards. And I await to see what the federal government do, and I absolutely believe there will be support for seniors, as we need to make sure we're focusing on making sure we have funding at a state level and a federal level to support seniors in our community.
Final wrap-up, Representative Greenman, thank you.
Thank you, and I guess I have a slightly different question, but to me, where we make up that 50%, what I hear you saying is we don't know. But the other piece I wanted to ask about, because you talked about value-based reimbursement and getting reimbursed, is, and we heard this, and one of the things I don't understand about this bill is it would require nursing homes to get resources up front for wage increases from the state, but then they would also be able to take value-based reimbursement. They're getting reimbursed for their costs. And I understand the 18 to 24-month delay is a challenge. It's a challenge that our nonprofits have when we make grants. It's a challenge that our vendors have often. It's a challenge that our school districts have. Most of those delays are related to the things we should be doing to check and make sure that those payments are right. In other committees yesterday, in this committee, because we don't hear bills in that other committee, in the Fraud Prevention Committee, we're talking about the rules that we need to put into place to make sure we're getting those payments right. Medicaid provider fraud is a real thing. We're probably going to talk about it. I heard Chair Robbins say we're going to talk about it yesterday in committee. But so how we deal with those payment delays is an important topic of conversation. But what I hear this bill does is it requires the state to pay up front, and then the nursing homes are going to get reimbursed again. And to me, the question is, how do you deal with it? One, should we be worried about double dipping? And two, how do you deal with that in the context of making sure that we're paying our providers and not double paying them?
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Baker and Representative Greenman. And I think we've talked about the issues with value-based reimbursement. I understand, and there's not inflation in that. And so this bill is simply to make sure that on page three of the existing rules for the standing board, if the legislator does not approve an appropriation under this section, the new standard approved by the board does not take effect. It's clearly in the rules for the standards board that it's going to go to the legislator for the wage proposals that everybody agrees we need to have wage increases. It states in the board's rules existing today that legislative body is going to happen and that piece is going to go. The expedited rulemaking. Also, when you allow that, you're not having the same type of engagement that you would have in the public and other factors. So this bill just strengthens all of those pieces that we can make it better.
Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. My understanding, Chair, is that there is a fiscal note request on the bill, and I believe the cost would be in the human services area. You mentioned the bill, the plans to go to the general register. I guess
yes.
I would think. Okay, so Chair. Well, why wouldn't it go to either? It really should go back to human services. That's where the cost would be. Without a fiscal note at all, it shouldn't be going even to ways and means. Certainly wouldn't go to the floor. Can you just explain why
yep.
this bill would go to
so
the floor?
So, Lee Pinto, because we got a fiscal note unavailable, it's not going to happen. They can't do a fiscal note. There is no fiscal cost to this bill. We are going to take it to the general register because there is no cost to the bill. Because the DHS can't do one. They can't do a fiscal cost. There's no cost to the bill. Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I heard is that it's not implementable. I guess I'm confused. So you're saying that DHS has confirmed that there is no cost, or you're saying that there will not be?
There's.
Clarify.
I'm sorry, Representative. There's no availability to a fiscal note on this in the way that it was written. So we're moving forward without a fiscal cost to this. There's not a cost to this bill. That's why it's going to the general register. Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it sounds like. That's interesting, though. Those sentences, to my mind, don't seem to go together, I guess, that you're saying that fiscal note cannot be calculated, but DHS is not able to implement the bill, and therefore that doesn't mean it means it doesn't have a cost. I'm trying to get my mind around that, I guess. So, okay, well, those are a wide variety of reasons to vote against the bill going to general register. But another point is we checked with our state government team, and this removal of expedited rulemaking definitely needs to be heard in state government. Like, that is how the process works. And so I would hope, Mr. Chair, we could send it to at least to state gov so that they could review the rulemaking issue in this bill. That is how the process works. So if we could get a thoughts on that, Mr. Chair. That is clearly a thing that is required, in addition to the other committee stops this bill needs to take for other reasons.
Unless somebody wants to make a motion to members, we can do that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're moving it on. So
absolutely,
we have three other votes, and I need to manage the time of the hearing today. We're going to wrap this up.
Representative Greenman. I'd make a motion to re-refer the bill to state government finance.
Okay, so moved. Members, all those in favor of sending this to state gov, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Does not carry.
Human Services, too. Human Services.
Anything further, Representative?
And one more motion.
I make a motion to refer this bill to Human Services where it belongs.
Okay. Members, there's a motion to move it to back to Human Services. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Does not pass. Final comments, Representative Zalesnikar, to your bill, House File 500, as amended.
Thank you, Chair Baker and members. This bill, while it's not perfect, what we would all hope to have for the future for seniors, it's a collaborative approach to make a bill better. And that's my focus. And thank you for hearing us today and supporting seniors in Minnesota.
Thank you so much, Representative Zalesnikar. For House File 500, the chair refers the motion again to push this to the General Register as amended. And Representative, you are having the next bill too as well. So we're going to change it up. To be clear, House File 500 as amended is on its way to the General Register. Members, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion carries. Thank you very much. Members, our next bill up, we're going to change the schedule just a tiny bit here because Rep. Zalesnikar is at the testifying table. We're going to take House File 718.
Mr. Chair?
Mr.
Chair, just to say, I think you had said the bill is on its way to the General Register, which I think confused our members because we had not thought that there was a vote. And you said it's on the way to the General Register. And then you called for the vote. I think we would have requested a roll call, but because we were confused because your phrasing of saying it's on its way. So I guess I just sort of ask, I know we're trying to move very quickly here. But we do want to be careful because on our side, we hadn't thought there was a vote. Then you said that. We thought, wait a second, we somehow had missed the vote. And then suddenly there was a vote. We were going to ask for a roll call on that
one. We can do that tonight if we want to come back tonight. I'm not taking the vote again today, but we passed the bill. So we're on.
No, I understand. Thank you very much. I just want to express concern for process.
Thank you so much. Representative Zalesnikar, I say that a lot today. I apologize. Messing that up. House File 718. To-year bill. The chair or Representative Zalesnikar actually brings forward House File 718. For possible inclusion in a future bill. Please
Thank
proceed.
Thank you, Chair Baker and members. This is a bill from a workforce-related item, hired, and thank you for joining me today. And they will be testifying. It is a workforce development nonprofit that has had strong outcomes in the Twin Cities area for job seekers across the area for a long time. And its career training pathways are important to this committee member, to all of us as committee members for Minneapolis-St. Paul, the suburbs, and greater Minnesota. And so this is another great example. I'll let our testifiers really share some of the highlights because making sure we have job retention, making sure we have pathways for those that are looking for placement in jobs is one of the fundamental goals of this committee. So, Chair, I will yield to my testifiers.
And thank you so much, Ms. Brecky. Again, any testimony today, too, we're looking at that three-minute mark or so. So thank you so much, Ms. Brecky. You're welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and thank you, Representative Zalesnikar. That is a tough name, I will say that. So my name is Julie Brecky. I'm the president and CEO of Hired, and I'm really thankful for your time today. As you may know, Hired is a long-standing nonprofit, a stable workforce development group with strong outcomes, and we actually connect job seekers to employers across the Twin Cities. We do holistically support individuals through job coaching, training, and support services, and we also build trusting relationships with the people that we work with, one person at a time. Last year, we worked with 4,300 individuals across the Twin Cities, and of those, all were low income. 71% would identify as people of color, 69% would identify as women, and more than 8,600 children were positively impacted by our family supports and services. Hired helped 1,250 people secure employment last year with an average wage of $27 an hour. I had to do the math. That's about $56,000 annually. That's a big deal for the people that we're working with and who would self-identify as low income. In 2023, the Senate Jobs Committee and the House approved Hired's first direct appropriation ever. And that was in support of our successful career pathway job training programs. And we are very thankful for that. I'm happy to let you know that was a wise investment. And as a direct result of that bill, Hired has trained 90 individuals, and we've placed 64 people in jobs, which is 80% of our contract goal. With nearly 4 months left of the contract. And just to be really clear, that's a deed contract that we negotiate with after what happens here. We actually get into a detailed negotiation with deed. And so that's actually monitored both fiscally and programmatically by deed to make sure that we're complying with and have transparency in the accountability of our programs. Today I'm here to respectfully request your support for Hired's bill. And it has two important components. That's a change from our first direct appropriation. One is to continue our successful career pathway trainings that does connect lower-skilled job seekers to family-sustaining wage with employers we're collaborating with and employers who are struggling to find a qualified workforce. The second component does also include funds to provide job retention services. I heard just in testimony today that it's not only about finding people, but it's about keeping people, and that we see every day in our work. That's really with customized employment coaching and supports, really is about helping people navigate a fragile transition to employment with supports, wraparound services, until they really just get those paychecks and have a balance in their checking account. There's still a worker shortage in the state of Minnesota, and we continue to see a mismatch between job seeker skills and what employers demand in a growing and changing economy. We need to invest in job training programs like those at Hired that help people skill up, connect to employers, and help people get and keep family-sustaining jobs. Hired seeks this direct appropriation because we believe services will contribute to building the talent pipeline that we desperately need, help workers advance and grow their career, increase job retention. All of these and more are stable to the workers, the employers, and helping keep Minnesota's economy strong and growing. Thank you for your time today, Chair Baker and committee members. And I am happy to introduce our next testifier, Liz Tratnick, who is a wonderful collaborating partner at Medtronic, one of our employer partners with us in a multifaceted way.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And reintroduce yourself, please, and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Baker and committee members. My name is Elizabeth Tratnick. I am currently a project coordinator at Medtronic in Brooklyn Center. I've worked there for 3 years, and during this time, I've had the opportunity to work closely with Hired. I would like to start with a quote from my mentor, Bill Shepard, shared with me from Angela Davis. "I'm no longer accepting the things I cannot change. I'm changing the things I cannot accept." Medtronic has partnered with Hired on several projects to prepare people for manufacturing positions and provide work-centered retention services. We developed a career pathway training with Hired that offers free short-term training to underemployed and unemployed individuals, preparing them for operator jobs on manufacturing lines with family-sustaining wages and benefits including tuition-free continuous education. We are impressed with Hired's ability to find and prepare employees, leading to successful full-time employment at Medtronic. Hired's graduates better understand the job and are more job-ready. Hired organizes trainee outreach, job readiness training, barrier alleviation, and connects trainees with credentialed training. Hired Pathways has led to a reduction in on-the-job training time with an average of 1 week, and it has increased our overall retention, employee retention. Additionally, Hired's pilot job retention project addresses barriers such as food insecurity, transportation, and childcare needs, improving communication and support for our second and third shift employees. This partnership aligns with the foundation of our business model and what we call our mission, to contribute to the human welfare by alleviating pain, restoring health, and extending life, also to recognize the personal worth of all employees, and to maintain good citizenship as a company. We have found that Hired is also striving to change the things we cannot accept, and it is truly invested in the success of employees and employers. And we look forward to continuing to build and strengthen our partnership with Hired for future opportunities. We're excited to be here today and really encourage the state to partner with Hired and to pass this bill so that more companies and workers can benefit from Hired and its support and services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Anyone else here to testify on the bill that you know of, representatives? All right, we'll take it to member questions. Any members? Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just make my usual point and appreciate the work of Hired. It sounds like it's been really terrific, and so grateful to you for that. I think there's great interest in the legislature. I'm hearing, and certainly in other committees, to be moving in the direction of competitive grants rather than direct appropriations, of which this would be one. And so just would urge Representative Zalesnikar and the testifiers just to be thinking about the grant programs that DEET has that may be applicable, perhaps with changes, perhaps there's something that's needed there. But at least if that is a direction the legislature ends up going, that would be something we'd want to make sure that you'd be in position to compete for those grants based on the work that you've been doing. So just want to encourage you to look into that.
Thank you. Any further comments from members? Seeing none, final wrap-up, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Baker. And members, having been on the workforce committee for my second term, I learned of this last term, and I'm happy to see positive outcomes. I think that's what this is about. And when you see successful outcomes, then ensuring that we're going to make sure that our employees have pathways to have the highest paying job to be able to thrive in Minnesota is the goal of our committee. And so I'm happy to support this bill, and thank you for hearing the bill today.
Thank you very much. House File 718 will be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Chair and Committee.
Next up is House File 1096. That'll be my bill. I'll be making a quick trip down there, and Chair Mecklen will step in quick. Thank you.
This is being laid over.
Yep.
Nice and easy.
House File 1096, I move to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Baker, would you care to share your bill?
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Again, really proud today to bring the bill forward here for Summit Academy. Some members have had a chance to go see this beautiful place. I have not yet got there. I missed my appointment the other day. But I just want to say thank you for taking the time for this. As you know, Minnesota has a critical workforce shortage. We hear about this in every one of our districts. As an employer myself, it's really a challenge that we all face. According to DEED, overall labor force trends amounted to 2 job openings for every 1 unemployed worker in October of 24, suggesting that there are not even enough workers to fill our open positions. Summit Academy is partnering with employers and bringing real solutions to help get our young people trained with real skills in the marketplace in fields like construction, financial services, IT services, and the medical field. After students go through the 20-week program, they are then placed into jobs. Not only does this help employers find a workforce, but more importantly, it helps transform the lives of our young people by removing barriers to empower them to develop their ability to earn and become contributing citizens. As a response to the demand in the market, Summit is also looking to double their enrollment and build a dental assistance program in the coming years. In addition, the construction and electrician programs currently have wait lists, with the electrician wait list now out to fall of 2025. Members, this is an important work, and I'd like to continue to turn this over, and I'll turn it over to my testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Baker. We have Leroy West and Dami Mafi to testify. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks, Mr. Chair and committee members. Again, Leroy West, President, CEO of Summit Academy. I'd like to thank you for the opportunities this morning to talk about Summit Academy and the mission and who we are and what we do. Summit Academy has been in the workforce for over 50 plus years. I'm so happy that I've been a part of 21 of those years, and I've seen the success and the outcomes and how we've impacted lives during that time. We produce workers with employable skills that start a career. And so we're looking at ourselves as not just, you know, a career technical education center, but more of a workforce solution institution meeting the industry demand. I'm going to take just a few minutes to walk you through a PowerPoint presentation that's located in that's in your packet. And starting with kind of the first pack, we're talking about the meeting the industry demand, equipping talent with their credentials in 20 weeks. Some of it is a 20-week training program, and we look at, you know, the various programs that we offer, electrician, carpentry, medical admin assistant, and IT specialist, and financial services. We are an accredited institution. We are accredited through Council of Occupation Education, but we also are licensed through Minnesota Office of Higher Ed. The next slide, we'll talk about our requests. I would like to thank you for your direct appropriation from the last biennium. Very, very excited that we were able to train over 1,000 students during that time. This year, we're asking for $2 million per year, $4 million over the total biennium from the Workforce Development Fund. This fund will help support the high-quality training to meet the demand for our talent, industry-recognized credentials, support our Student Support Services Fund. They help students make it through the 20 weeks, but also transition to the workforce as well. And what's also very important about who we are is nobody pays 1 cent out of their pocket to attend our training. Again, we also plan to double our enrollment, so going from 1,000 to 2,000 a year, and expanding our GED program. And as said earlier, the electrician program is one of our most popular programs, and we know that there's such a shortage there, and we're working with our industry partners because there's a number of data centers that are coming up, and in addition to the need in that area, we have a waiting list, and we're looking at expanding our training to accommodate that. We're also launching a dental assistant program as well. That's going to be starting this fall with a lot of our industry partners. We have students come to us from all over the Twin Cities. We have over 130 zip codes that students are attending some, and 80% are from Minneapolis and the surrounding suburbs. The other 20% are from St. Paul and the surrounding suburbs. However, we have students driving from St. Cloud, Rochester, Shakopee to attend our school. Our average placement wage is $45,000 a year, and this is from students who are before they enroll, they make an average of $23,000 a year. And in 20 weeks, we're placing them at $45,000 a year with no out-of-pocket costs. If anybody else in a household who's making at least $18 an hour, they now have a household income of $82,000 a year. And the median household income, according to Deeds in the Twin Cities, is $80,000. We are now beginning to invest in the journey after Summit as well. So just during the 20 weeks, when a student comes to us and we get to the bullet point that say, all right, now they get their job, is life after Summit. So we want to, what it takes for them to invest in them to get to that 60,000 to 80,000 is very, very important to us as well. Also in the slide, we'll highlight a lot of our partners. We have, this list isn't exhaustive. We have over 169 employers that we placed our graduates with last year. And we're looking for more. In your slide, it also touched on where our revenue sources come from. 61% comes from the our corporate support, comes from philanthropy, and 14% comes from our student financial aid, 13% comes from the state, and 5% other. So we have a diversified resource of income, and just like coming to you asking for support, we're also going to our corporates as well asking for their support. So I'd like to thank you so much for your time, and I'd like to yield the rest of my time to my other testifier.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself and please proceed.
My name is Dami Mafe. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Attending Summit Academy OIC changed my life. I was working odd jobs to support my family and friends around me, but this experience gave me the structure and carve out my own path in life. I'm now in a new career and exactly where I belong. Summit gave me the fundamentals I needed in the field that I've always been passionate about in IT. There is no cost associated with attending this, the course. Some people in my situation were passionate about IT but did not have the proper guidance to actually pursue it further and struggled learning on their own. Some provided mentors to meet me where I was at and help me with my journey. They often were sounding boards for people inside and outside of work. After completing Summit Academy IT training, I was offered a job at Atomic Data, where I'm still employed today. I'm currently a solutions consultant at Atomic Data. Without the knowledge I gained from Summit Academy, I would not be here today. I'm starting in the NOC, a low-level entry position at Atomic Data. I'm now in a sales role where I'm making salary and commission based on my efforts. Summit Academy is a great career training solution in the Twin Cities, filled with great teachers who care about their students. I may have not been the best student when I came in, but they met me where I'm at, and they put me in a place where I am today, and they helped me change my life. Thank you.
Well said.
Thank you for that. Is there any other public testimony? Seeing none, member questions, Representative Wayne Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for Baker to presenting it, and thank you. It's good seeing you again. I just saw you on Monday as I came out and toured the facility, and I was very, very impressed. I mean, the whole operations and your plans for growth, bringing together another area back in. The training program that I witnessed was very impressive from the structure to where it was and how you spend your first 10 weeks, your next 10 weeks. I was able to see the carpentry, the electrical programs. I also saw the ingenuity and the technology being used from the virtual training that is being used and being able to go in and put a VR on there and like you were just there, and very impressive where the teacher actually could see the screens that you're working on too, to be able to. And as somebody who is a employer, using where more virtual is coming in the HVAC industry and how to repair and actually putting technicians out in the field that are using virtual to diagnose and repair, that was very impressive. So that means you're getting students out there ready to go. I also was very impressed with the fact that you're not just teaching technology or the tech skills. You're turning out a fully rounded person that understands the responsibility of showing up as somebody that has employed people that have had struggled in the past because the outside life gets in the way of work life and the success that they can have. And the tools that you are doing that and teaching people and working with students to make sure if they're struggling, you're there to help them get over those humps. And the students were very active. It was just very impressive program. And so I think we should be continue to help them and to be able to come out and not be held back because of money. That was a great what I saw. So thank you.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I have not been out to the facility yet, but I just got invited. So hopefully I can make that happen. Quick question. So I love that you were talking about how the students come out of this with no out-of-pocket costs to them, and then they have accreditations and licenses to go forth. And that sounds similar to union apprenticeship programs, specifically looking at the electrician and carpentry. In those apprenticeship programs, the students are on the job making money, so not only do they have no out-of-pocket costs, but they are earning an income while in the apprenticeship and moving up through the program. I didn't see if that is similar at your organization. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other member questions?
It was a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Thank you so much, Representative Berg. We are considered a pre-apprentice training. So we work with the union. So we basically are training them and giving them 20 weeks or 600 hours before they even move into the apprenticeship training. So when they get employed, they're now become a union member, and then they're continuing with the apprenticeship training as you just talked about. So this is prior to them getting into the apprenticeship model.
Any follow-up, Representative Berg?
Yeah, thank you so much. Okay, so you are then working with our local unions, our carpenters, electricians, all of that,
yes,
sort of funneling them towards the full apprenticeship programs.
Yes.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Baker, for bringing this bill. I actually learned about Summit Academy from IBEW and the Carpenters and that pathway, and I think we've heard a few other bills like this where I think we are in state investments are best when they're sort of coordinated to the full set of relationships and organizations that are focused on folks throughout their career. So I really appreciate that. And long before I was in the legislature, learned about this. And just also want to say, as a Minneapolis delegation member, Summit Academy in Minneapolis, the role that it has played in the community has been really, really important. And so I think it's a couple of decades now. I remember learning about it in my 20s, which will date me. But just want to say thank you for all the work you do. We hear about it in community, locally. I know that you serve folks from all over, but it is also a really important thing for our city. So just wanted to say thank you and appreciate the work.
Chair Baker, any closing comments?
Just again, members, I appreciate having this being moved on to further consideration.
Excuse me, Chair Baker. Representative Frazier has a quick comment or question.
Very quick comment. Mr. West, good to see you. Mafi, thank you for coming to testify. Always like to see folks that have gone through the program to talk about the successes that they're having now. Just some of the county's been doing good work for a long time. You're making a real impact on a community and have been, and you represent excellence, and you demand that from folks that go to the program. And I know that it absolutely has a huge positive impact on the community. So thank you, Chair Baker, for bringing the bill this session, and we're looking forward to continued support.
Chair Baker, House File 1096, I'll make my motion to lay over for possible inclusion.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. The next House File we're going to have up is House File 1246 that Representative Hussein was going to be presenting, but unfortunately he's not feeling well, so Representative Greenman.
And thank you. We're putting House File 1246 again in front of the committee today. Thank you very much. And thank you for stepping in.
Thank you, Chair Baker. And this is Representative Hussein's bill, but I had the privilege of carrying and working with NDC in my first term in the legislature in 2021 on their work. So I'm pretty familiar with NDC, as I think many of you all are. Thank you. A few of you, I think, are co-sponsors on this bill. Neighborhood Development Corporation has a three-decade track record of connecting low-income folks of color, communities, underserved communities, to opportunities that they need for success for small businesses, our local businesses that really help our communities thrive. There are around 600 existing NDC-assisted businesses in the Twin Cities. You may have been at some of them. In my neck of the woods, the Midtown Global Market, many of those businesses and the incubator that they have there have been allowed to or have been assisted in really becoming successful because of the work of NDC. They reach businesses that operate on the margins of our economy, businesses that are micro and small and just getting started, that employ over 3,200 people and return over $10 million to the state in income and sales taxes. So I know in the interest of time, do we have until 10? Oh, we might have a little time. Just to talk a few short things, and I'm going to leave it to my testifiers, particularly the business owner who's been working with NDC. But the kinds of things they do, business training, business services, and technical assistance, helping the smallest businesses really get those business skills to thrive, access to loan capital and revolving capital, and affordable commercial space on key commercial commercial corridors through their business incubators. One, which is right down the block in Representative Hussein's business, also the Midtown Global Market and a few others. The other thing I think that some folks don't know that they do, but we've been supporting as a state, is the work that they've been doing outside of the Twin Cities to connect with incubators and connect with small businesses and small business incubators throughout the state. The Initiative Foundation in Central Minnesota has gone through the program with NDC and is now operating a similar program providing training and entrepreneurial technical assistance and loan programs. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think on all of these bills, we are best heard from the folks who are doing the work themselves, so I will turn it over to my testifiers to continue.
Very good. Thank you very much, Representative. Is it Renee? Renee, thank you. Please proceed. Introduce yourself and please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Renee Dossman, President and CEO of the Neighborhood Development Center. Thank you and great gratitude to the Chair Baker and members of this committee. NDC, as Representative Greenman said, supports entrepreneurs and businesses across Minnesota, helping them grow and create jobs. I'm here today to discuss our work and our appropriation to strengthen that work, those efforts. So there's four pillars of NDC. The first pillar is entrepreneur training and small business workshops. We do trainings twice a year, in the spring and the fall, and workshops throughout the year. This is an opportunity for entrepreneurs to build their business plan. We support about 200 entrepreneurs with this first stage of the pillar. The second stage is we're CDFI. We're a community development financial institution. We provide loans to entrepreneurs. The biggest opportunity for our entrepreneurs is access to capital. We provide loans up to $250,000. We help about 50 businesses a year with loan capital. Third pillar is business services and technical assistance. This is where the entrepreneur might need help with marketing, branding, accounting, which we'll talk a little bit more about. We're going to be laser focused on that, as well as their mental health. So we provide those services. We have about 5,000 hours of technical assistance a year. The fourth pillar is the commercial real estate pillar. That's affordable commercial real estate and incubators that we'll talk a little bit more about. We have five of those. A new incubator that we have is located on the east side of St. Paul in partnership with Metro State. It's on cybersecurity, so entrepreneurs can come in and get their equipment cleaned, and then the students can actually work with those entrepreneurs. Some of the outcomes from NDC. The businesses that we've supported have generated about $5.3 million in annual income tax and $5.3 million in annual sales tax. The businesses have created about 3,250 jobs. And what I'm most impressed with is it increases their annual household income by about $25,000. The ask today before you is $2.25 million over 2 years. The first part, $800,000, is to support core entrepreneur services, what I mentioned with the 800 entrepreneurs that go through our the four pillars each year. The second piece is for technical assistance for building the financial management skills and of these entrepreneurs. We're discovering that there's a lot more work that needs to be done for these entrepreneurs as it relates to their finances. Senator Draham and I actually had a really in-depth conversation about that because it's becoming apparent to us that this is where we need to focus more at NDC, so we're asking for your support with that, as well as technical assistance in Greater Minnesota. We do pass-through dollars to several organizations in Greater Minnesota, St. Cloud, Moorhead, and Duluth. As a matter of fact, I'll be in Virginia, Minnesota next week at an entrepreneur conference with some of these organizations, talking about entrepreneurship in Greater Minnesota. And they're going to be with us, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm from Duluth, so to get up there is nice. And then talking about cybersecurity, the center that we've opened on the east side, we're asking for $75,000 this year for marketing and operations of that. We feel like this is crucial to get those entrepreneurs to the next level and to be involved in technology for entrepreneurs. And then finally, I will close because I know I was talking really fast because I only have 3 minutes. So I want to introduce you to Dalton Outlaw. Dalton is a longtime NDC entrepreneur, the president and CEO of Outlaw Development, and the owner of Element Fitness. His journey from small business owner to community developer is exactly the kind of impact we strive to support at NDC. I'll let him share his work and vision. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. That's a pretty big buildup for you, Mr. Outlaw. So I hope you're ready to go. Welcome to the committee, and please proceed.
Chair Baker, members of the committee, I'm honored to be present here to testify and grateful to stand with NDC. Again, my name is Dalton Outlaw. I'm a father, husband, business owner, and an affordable housing developer born and raised in a Frogtown neighborhood. I'm here today to share how NDC Neighborhood Development Center has helped me overcome challenges and achieve success. As the founder and CEO of Element Boxing Gym and Outlaw Development, I faced many barriers starting at a young age, growing up in a low-income household. Poverty takes a toll on your mental, physical, and emotional health, making success even harder to achieve. Despite earning my college degree, I still lacked resources to grow my businesses. That changed when I met and connected with NDC. From the start, they treated me like family, even before I had any assets or owned anything. They helped me expand and scale my business tenfold, and their mentorship led to me becoming the two-time Entrepreneur of the Year amongst receiving other notable awards. Most recently, NDC has financed my six-unit affordable housing project on the east side of St. Paul without unnecessary barriers. Unlike traditional lenders, they didn't just invest in a project, they invested in me. Their support has allowed me to create opportunities, not just for myself, but for my employees, my community, and future generations. As a father of five sons, my success has inspired them. They now have the goal of continuing and growing and expanding our family businesses when they grow up. Thanks to NDC, they now have the foundation and support to build on this legacy. The Bill 1246 will enable NDC to strengthen its mission while most importantly continuing to empower the entrepreneurs it serves. By increasing resources and access to opportunities, each dollar will plant seeds in entrepreneurs to build for generations. I stand here as proof of what's possible when organizations invest in entrepreneurs, not just in their businesses, but in their dreams. For that, I'm forever grateful and thankful to be able to testify here and stand alongside Neighborhood Development Center. Thank you.
Mr. Outlaw, thank you so much, and congratulations on your awards recently. So we wish you only the very, very best.
Thank you
so
very much.
My quick comment, again, I'm proud to be the number two author on this bill. I was not able to meet you, Renee, when I was, I think you were out of town when you were there, and I had a fabulous visit with your staff. They did a great job. So thank you. It's good to see you all again. And we really had some, I want to just share this because the synergy in that building was amazing. You know, the incubator center and the IT area, the loan center, that just, they really have it all together in that beautiful facility. But also I really enjoy talking about the other side of business that we need to work on, and that's the policy of how to help new entrepreneurs like you get up and running without the big arm of government sometimes. Sometimes we get in the way, and I think we're trying to make sure we don't do that. So if we can help you to get these kind of things going, that's super important. But we also have to make sure that we have honest conversations about what isn't working, and we need to hear from new entrepreneurs like you, Mr. Outlaw. So I just want to say thank you to the organization. I'm proud to support this today, and I look forward to working with you some more. So other member questions, please.
Thank you.
If there's any. Here, Lee Pinto, I got to give you the final word. Hey.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Well, I'll just say, yeah, NDC. I think a number of us toured the NDC facility in January, and just so impressive. I love the whole building, that whole space, and you do such important work. And you know, you may have heard the comment along the way, right, that we are thinking about how overall in state government we can restructure how funds go out, but that is not in any way a criticism of the individual organizations such as yours. But I certainly would encourage you to keep in conversation with us that if and as we're making some shifts, we do want to make sure the work that you are doing continues to be funded and supported. So thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman. And thank you, Representative Hussein is not here. I think he's not feeling well, but our bill author for his work as well. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Lee Pinto. Thank you. And yeah, wrap it up. Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. I understand. I hope that I can be at the table as you think through that. I'd love to do that. We started there doing things through deed, and then we moved to here. As a result, it's spread, not enough money and spread too thin. So for us to continue to have the impact and to do the things that we need to do, that's why we're in front of you today. But I appreciate that and would love to be at the table.
Final comments, Representative Freeman.
Thank you. I didn't even tell Ms. Dozman that the way to get this committee support is say something about Duluth. because we have three. I think we have the entire Duluth and surrounding delegation on the committee. So you took that. But I will say, in all seriousness, NDC is doing the kind of work that I think we as a legislature, I know that Chair Baker and I have had conversations about how do we support small local business? How do we support the entrepreneurs and the micro businesses? I think when we talk about policy and having NDC and their entrepreneurs at the table is really important, because we oftentimes, our business agenda is oftentimes dominated by the folks who have lobbyists here, which are the biggest multinational businesses. And what we have in every corner of our state are small, are the gyms and the pharmacies and the retail and the restaurants that are the things that make our communities thriving and great, and we want to support. So with that, I'd ask for your support. I know we're laying this over, and our continued conversation about the small local businesses that make our communities great.
Thank you very much, Representative. Again, thank you to the testifiers. We are going to lay this bill over, House File 1246, for future consideration. Members, that concludes our business today. A little preview of Tuesday. Again, we are hearing the SCUBA bill on Tuesday. That was deferred because of the storm. That'll be our first bill up, and then we'll have a couple more bills, and that day is still kind of being tweaked a little bit, and then it'll be another busy week ahead. So with that, members, we are adjourned.